This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Mack Weldon. If you're like most men, you've probably been wearing the same underwear since you were a teenager. Well, not the same underwear, like the same brand of underwear. But there's been some changes since then. And one of the companies at the head of these changes is Mack Weldon. They've got a smart design that's super comfortable. And all their underwear is made with antimicrobial fabric, so it eliminates any odor. Besides underwear, Mack Weldon makes undershirts and socks with the same antimicrobial fabric. If you want to try Mack Weldon out at a discount, go to mackweldon.com and use promo code AOM at checkout for 20% off. Mackweldon.com, promo code AOM at checkout for 20% off. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So I know there's probably several of you out there who are listening who homeschool their kids, keep your kids out from public or private schools, but you follow a curriculum at home that you bought online or maybe you developed yourself. Well, there's another type of at-home schooling that has no curriculum. It's called unschooling. I'm completely fascinated by this concept. Basically, you keep your kids home and you put them in situations where they have to learn math in order to complete the task, and surprisingly, they learn math. Well, my guest today, he's homeschooled or unschooled his two boys. His name's Ben Hewitt. He's a writer, lives in northern Vermont. And today on the show, we're going to discuss his experience unschooling his two boys and letting them run wild in the wilderness of Vermont and the things they've learned because of that. But we also talk about Ben's decision when him and his wife decided to build a homestead in Vermont, a house they built together from scratch on their own, how they did that, why they did that, why they decided to live a very simple lifestyle. And then we'll get into the book that Ben wrote about his unschooling his two boys called Homegrown. Really fascinating discussion. After I did the interview, made me want to run off to Vermont, sell everything, and unschool my two kids and let them run wild in Vermont. But I'm still here in Tulsa. So without further ado, got Ben Hewitt, and we're going to talk about unschooling and homegrown. Ben Hewitt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I don't know how I came across you. I think I read an article that you may have published, and I saw it online. But I had to have you on because you live in Vermont, and you live like the quintessential like Vermont life. I think what like every American imagines, like it's a postcard. Like, I mean, you live on a farm with your family.
A postcard with black flies.
Right. Postcard with black flies. Maybe we could talk about some of take off the cover of the romanticism of rural living a bit. But you published this book, and it was really great. It's called Homegrown: Adventures in Parenting Off the Beaten Path, Unschooling and Reconnecting with the Natural World. And it's about the conscious decision you and your wife have made to not put your sons in public schooling. You don't even homeschool them. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in a bit because it's interesting. But before, let's talk about how you got to where you are today. You started off, you and your wife, you live on a homestead in a home you built yourself. You farm and you write to supplement your income, but you primarily farm. How did you make that decision? I mean, was that something when you were 13 years old, you decided, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. Like, I'm going to go live on a farm. I'm going to grow my own food.
Yeah. When I was 13, I think I was going to be, a speed metal guitarist. So it definitely, and I would say there never was sort of that inflection point where I was just like, this is what I'm going to do with my life. The evolution, I guess, of our homestead and the way we inhabit it, has been sort of, it's been much more of a process over a long period of time. I think the only aspect of what I do and how I fill my days now that really did have perhaps a little more foresight to it was that I did realize at some point, quite some time ago now, that I wanted to write for, and hopefully for a living. So there was definitely a point where there was a light bulb moment with my writing for sure, where I was like, wow, I could actually like make a living writing. And as anyone who has you know, frustratingly, in some cases, written for free or tried to find the time to write under any circumstances. You know, that's the realization of that has been a real blessing and something that I'm really try to remain grateful for. like most people, I'm susceptible to becoming rather jaded with my circumstances, but I try to really be grateful about that. And so that was something I did really think a lot about and plan. Definitely not as early as 13, but a little bit later in my life.
And so were a lot of the decisions you made afterwards about basically you've just, you know, at a very early age. I mean, even when you were 16, you dropped out of public school, dropped out of high school.
Right. I did.
And I mean, was that a part of you? Was there like an underlying ethos? You didn't want to go that conventional path. I mean, what did you find in the conventional path that didn't appeal to you? Was it like the constraints, the lack of freedom? What was going on there?
Yeah, I think I felt very, I was very bored as a student. And I think a lot of, probably most of your listeners are out of their high school years, but I'm sure a lot of them can relate to that. And so I felt very, very bored. It felt tedious to me. I remember really strongly this feeling of a lack of respect for my time as an individual. And it just wasn't a great fit for me. I'm really keen to point out that, I was not, it's not like I dropped out of school so I could pursue like a self-designed study in, nuclear thermodynamics or something like that. I mean, I was not a great student, and I was a little bit of a hoodlum, I guess, at that point in my life, not in the sense of like actually doing harm to others, but I was definitely, partying too much and just sort of being a general, teenage ne'er-do-well, I guess, in a lot of ways. Which, in and of itself, I think was a reflection of that boredom that I was feeling and that sort of level of disrespect and trying to find my own way in the world, particularly when it was really obvious that I didn't really fit very well within the prescribed circumstances of the public education system. So I was super fortunate that I had a really supportive parents. Like that was a real saving grace for me. And they were super supportive. They really facilitated my leaving school when it became really obvious that it wasn't the right thing for me. And they offered, unconditional love and support, even though I was, taking a path that I'm sure was terrifying to them at the time. But, I really look back at that as that decision as it was a blessing in disguise in a lot of ways. I think in a lot of ways, the life that I've created now may not have happened or would have been more difficult to make happen, I think, if I had gone a more conventional route. I came from a family that had a lot of higher education in its background. Both of my parents went to school. My dad has a master's. Ironically enough, when I left high school, my dad worked for the Vermont Department of Education, believe it or not. So I think there was this presumption that I would probably be, follow that path. Because we were a family of modest means, it would have meant accruing a not insignificant amount of debt. And so sometimes I wonder, and of course there's no way to know. I mean, it's like, I can't back up and do it all over again, a different version of it. But I do wonder that if I had gone on to school, and by school, I mean college, university, if I would have just had the financial, independence, since I would have had to assume a lot of loans, to pursue writing as a career path. I mean, who knows? It also occurs to me that it's just as likely that I would have gone on to school and I would have loved it and I would have ended up in some amazing job that would have been dependent on that education. So I can't, I'm not here to say that I know for certain. But whatever the case may be, I have no regrets about making that choice. And I think that for me, it was at the time the right choice to make, and I still feel that way.
And so what did you do after you dropped out? I mean, it sounds like you didn't set yourself some sort of like curriculum, but I'm sure there was something you learned. You went through like the school of heart, like you probably learned something during this period where immediately after you dropped out.
Right. So that's a great way to phrase it. I mean, I think I learned what I didn't want to do, which was to continue sort of down that path of, smoking too much pot and drinking too much beer and just not really, doing much productive with my life. I was sort of hanging out with a crowd that did a lot of that. And that didn't last that long for me, actually. And then I also was, at the time, I picked up some jobs on construction crews. And, you know, interestingly enough, you know, here's another sort of aspect of this atypical education that I had. And when I say education, I really feel strongly that my education did not end when I left school, and in many ways only sort of just began when I left school. But I had the luxury, I guess, during that period of my life to learn a lot of skills, or at least the basis for a lot of skills that I've been able to rely on and do rely on to this day. And so, when people sort of wonder, you know, how we do the things, some of the things we do nowadays, which is, you know, build our own house and utilize a lot of these skills. I mean, I feel really blessed to have had that opportunity to develop some of those. So a lot of those skills, I think, actually liberated me later in life.
Right. But the thing was, you probably didn't know at the time that this was going to come in handy later on, right?
No, it was not a plan.
Right.
Yeah. Right. I was not. I absolutely not. I mean, I think I had a friend at the time. One of my best friends was himself having a rather atypical teenage upbringing. And he was actually homeschooled, and he was building his own place at the age of 17 on his parents' land. And that actually had a real influence on me. So, I think watching that, the progress of that place and seeing that, you know, this was something that was like possible for a young person to do. I'm sure that got tucked away somewhere, perhaps unconsciously, you know, but I wasn't thinking to myself, okay, I'm going to go learn the trade so that, you know, 15 or 20 or 30 years from now, I can build my own house. That wasn't the thought process.
Right. And I love that because, I mean, I get a lot of emails and letters from young men, right? They're like 18, 20s, and like, there's a lot of anxiety. They feel like they have to have a plan. They have to have everything planned out till like they're 50, right? Or till they retire. And they tell me like, here's the options I could do. And I just tell them like, just do something, right? You're going to pick up stuff along the way you don't know at the time is going to be useful later on, but like, just get started with life and move in some direction, and then new directions will open up and you can follow that because you've acquired skills along the way that are useful for that new direction.
Yes. So, I mean, one of the things I've noticed in my life, I'm going to back up and take sort of more like the 30,000 foot view,
yeah.
I really believe strongly that if you structure your life in such a way that you can leave yourself open to serendipity, you will, in the long run, be better off. And things will open up for you and happen for you that you might never have imagined. So for me, you know, a lot of the things that have been most meaningful and impactful in my life are things that I could never have planned for. And so I think your advice actually is really, really sound. I think culturally we place way too much emphasis on creating this sort of roadmap for our lives. In a way, that roadmap becomes, and in some ways, I think it becomes its own prison.
Yeah, I agree. Because you get like goal focus, right? It's like only goal blindness, I guess is what you call it.
Goal blind, right. Yeah, no, that's a great term. Yeah.
Actually, it comes from like the military. Air Force pilots or fighter pilots aren't supposed to like focus on one target because it closes their perception to other possible threats.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So you dropped out of high school, you did construction work, you did all sorts of different types of odd jobs for a few years. Then you met your future wife or now wife.
Correct.
You guys were dating, boyfriend, girlfriend. And then the two of you decide to buy 40 acres in northern Vermont. And build a homestead. And I think a lot of people hear that, they think, oh boy, that must be really nice. It's like the quintessential Currier and Ives dream. I would do that if I had the money.
Sure.
But you and your wife didn't have much money. So can you talk about the process of how you made this happen for you too?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, I think it is important to acknowledge that it is true that we didn't have a lot of money, and we didn't come from what most of us would consider money in this day and age. We're both from, you know, middle-class families. So that, you know, it was us sort of making our way in the world, but of course we were benefiting from all sorts of other sort of entrenched privileges. So I think that there is, you know, that is important to acknowledge.
Sure.
That. But Yeah, at the same time, you know, we definitely, it was a struggle. I was at the time, you know, flipping between construction and working in a bike and ski shop. I was a really avid backcountry skier and cyclist. And so that was kind of my off season job whenever things got slow in the construction and the trades. And she was actually working on a vegetable farm of all things. So I think between the two of us, we made like $20 an hour. You know, this is not a king's ransom at all. And so the way we did it basically was inhabit a series of pretty deplorable little hovels that we were able to rent either for, you know, I think the most, there was a period there of like 2 or 3 years when we were pretty intensely saving. And I think during that entire period, we never paid more than like $150 a month for rent. And then during one long period in the sort of final push to saving money, we actually lived in a tent on our friend's land into December in Vermont. And I remember, you know, very, very clearly living in this tent or sleeping in this tent, and we had this stick that we had propped up next to this mattress, and the stick was so that we could push the snow off the roof of the tent without getting out, so the tent didn't collapse on us, you know? So there was this long period of living in what most people these days would consider really substandard conditions. And we were able, I don't know, do you want the whole, like, people ask this question a lot, and I think it's a great question because, and I'm happy to talk about the finances because I think too often this stuff gets glossed over.
Right.
Don't want to talk about money and all of this stuff. And I'm totally fine.
No, let's go.
So I'll give you the whole like financial rundown.
Yeah. I mean, you also mentioned that you guys bathed in a river, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. We still do that quite a bit, actually. So, I mean, the other benefit of all this, you know, is like it set our standards and expectations to a point where that later in our lives, it's been really easy to sort of satisfy our material needs, if that makes any sense.
Right.
Right. So it's always easier, you know, it's easier if your standard living and your material expectations are set high, it's difficult to walk those back down, if you know what I'm saying.
Right.
So
it's loss aversion. Right?
Yeah, thank you. That's the term I was looking for. Anyway, we managed to save $15,000, on this sort of, you know, Olympic level frugality, measures. And with that, we were able to get a loan from the bank, for another $15,000, and we bought a piece of land that cost $30,000. The banks, at least around here, if you want to buy bare land, you've got to have 50%. So our budget was $30,000, and we actually found a piece of land that we really liked. After a year of relatively fruitless searching, we found the piece of land that we bought for $30,000. So once we bought that, we borrowed $10,000 from a friend who had some resources. And we built what I call sort of the prototypical hippie shack, which was just like a two-room cabin, you know, up on piers, and really, really simple little wood stove. And we built that, and we lived there until we had paid off. And this for me is sort of a key point. We're really debt averse. And sometimes I joke that the real reason we live this way is essentially because I'm lazy, which is to say I don't really ever... I really hope to never be in a spot in my life where I have to take a job I don't want or like simply because I'm trying to service debt. So a lot of my, you know, life choices are really sort of structured around the idea that not having debt affords me a level of autonomy that a more indebted lifestyle does not. So we, all the way along, even though we did take debt from time to time, we were really, really careful to pay it down before we took on more debt, and we were also really certain that it never became something that we couldn't handle pretty easily. So anyway, we built this little cabin, we paid back our friend, we paid back the bank, and then we did actually take out another loan from the bank, a construction loan, and we added on and built what most people consider a more appropriate sized and a more commodious house in 21st century America. So that was kind of the progression. We've actually since sold that, actually just last year, we sold that property. And we had so much fun spending 20 years creating our perfect homestead that we decided we wanted to do it again. So I'm speaking to you right now from the inside of a house that's about 90% finished that we've been building over the last 6 months or so.
Wow, that's great. And I imagine, was the first go around, was it like pretty rough? Like, I mean, I know you had construction experience, but building an entire house, I mean, that just seems like daunting. I'm sure there was a lot of...
I should point out that we have had help along the way. So it wasn't like we did, 100% of the work, right. But we were definitely the primary labor force.
It's a good example of communitarianism, right?
Yeah, exactly. And we're really fortunate to have a lot of friends in the trades, have skills that we can rely on when we run into the upper end of our own experience and knowledge and skill level, which happens more frequently than I really care to admit on your show. But so the second go around, we did have a lot more experience building this place. We also had a much better sense of what we wanted, and having lived in a place for 20 years, having seen our sort of lives evolve, it felt like this opportunity to do this amazing thing, and like, wow, we could do this over again and make all these little tweaks that we've always talked about making. So, here we are, and it's been actually just an amazing process. Really, really, I've just had a ton of fun.
That's awesome.
But I think all of us have, actually.
Yeah. So. Well, I'm curious. I mean, what was it that was driving you during those, like, when you were, using the stick to push snow off the tent, and
right.
There was, you had a battle, big black flies, little, what was it that was like, okay, we're doing it for this reason. What was the underlying ethos behind this madness?
Oh, that's such a great question. I've never really sat down and like thought about it, and I don't know that there was an underlying ethos or a singular underlying ethos. I know we both felt really compelled to inhabit a piece of land where we could do a lot of the things we do now, which is, we raise animals, we have cows, we have pigs, we have chickens, we do a lot of foraging. We have gardens, we have an orchard. I mean, these are all things that were really important to us, even going back as far as, our early 20s when we first met. So there was definitely this sort of shared vision we had. It was a little hazy. We didn't know exactly what it was going to look like, but, from not long after my then girlfriend, now wife, Penny, and I met, there was this sort of shared vision that we were going to have this small farmstead, homestead, farm, whatever you want to call it. So that was definitely a motivating factor. There was no sort of, at that point anyway, sort of more like, larger picture philosophical underpinnings.
Thoreau-esque type.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That wasn't what it was about. It was like, this is what we want to do. And I would say that's somewhat true even to this day. I don't wake up in the morning, thinking about, how I'm going to do my little part to change the world. Although I think it's important that we all reflect on that at some point in our lives. But mostly I wake up in the morning, genuinely pretty excited about the opportunity to do the things that we are able to do around here every day. So, I actually enjoy getting up in the morning and having chores to do. It gives me a feeling of purpose, and I like, I'm grateful for the relationships with our animals and with the land. I like the physical labor that's involved in this life. I think we really have come to a place where we shortchange the benefits and the enjoyment that comes of manual labor in this culture. And so a lot of it is a little bit of just sort of like, this is what our version of a fulfilling life is. And I totally understand that it's not everyone's version. I get that 100%. But for us, this is, this is what feels meaningful to have this work to do on a day in, day out basis.
It seems like also like a sense of place is really important to you and your wife. That's what I got from the book. Like, you wanted to be really connected to a physical place and all that's involved with that.
It's totally true. Although it feels weird saying that now, having just sort of made this move.
Right. We didn't move. You know? didn't move that far.
Right. No, we didn't. And but you're totally right. And a sense of place and having that, you know, feeling embedded. And actually, where we moved to is essentially in on the periphery of the same community. So community-wise, it's really actually hardly different at all. But being embedded in a community, having an awareness of place and region is really, really important to us. And also having our, you know, the ways that your lives become shaped by community and region. I mean, really, we inhabit a very transient society at this point, and as any first world society is in the 21st century. And there's some amazing benefits that go along with that, but there is, I think, a wider spread sort of sense of placelessness that comes of that. And I think a lot of people feel that and feel that a loss of having that connection, whether it's to a particular piece of land or to a community or even just to a region. And that is one thing that is really, really important to us. And really, you know, this life is all about trade-offs. You know, it's like, I think it is really easy to sort of look at it from the outside looking in, and it seems really idyllic. And there are aspects of it, of course, that are really idyllic. But there are trade-offs. I mean, we don't really get to travel. We don't have that luxury, in part from finances, in part because we have animals that depend on our care. In part, you know, in the winter, we rely only on wood for heating. So there's a lot of aspects that make, you know, that really do ensure that we don't really have those opportunities. We can't just sort of, you know, close the door behind us and be gone. So, but for us, you know, and there are times absolutely when we wish we could do that more readily. But the opportunity to sort of really embed ourselves here is more important to us than that flexibility.
So you can't have it all.
You can't have it all. Yeah. Right. But who can?
Who can? No one can.
I don't know. I guess Donald Trump. I mean,
maybe Donald Trump can have it all.
That's right.
Maybe Donald will buy a piece of property next to you.
Yeah. I don't even want to go there. All right.
We're going to take a quick break for your word from our sponsor. All right, guys. So when I first started The Art of Manliness 8 years ago, I couldn't afford a designer. So I had to do the designing myself. And I knew nothing about HTML, nothing about CSS, nothing about PHP. And I basically had to, through trial and error, figure things out. It was a time consuming affair. It took me 2 months to get the first design, and it sucked. It was terrible. Nowadays, creating a website is super easy, particularly when you have Squarespace. Squarespace is a website that allows you to create beautiful looking websites, all with just point and click and drag. That's it. So if you have a company, if you have a portfolio you want to show off, but you don't want to spend the time or a ton of money hiring a professional designer, you need to check out Squarespace. They got 24/7 online support. Their websites look great on all devices, desktop, mobile, smartphone, tablet, you name it, looks great. If you want to try Squarespace out at a discount, I got an offer for you. Go to squarespace.com and use offer code ARTOFMAN at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase. And also, that'll show your support for The Art of Manliness. Again, squarespace.com, promo code ARTOFMAN at checkout for 10% off. We thank Squarespace for their support of The Art of Manliness podcast. And now back to the show. Let's talk about this. So you and wife established your little homestead, and then you'll have your first son
right
in the home. I thought that was pretty cool. Like, you actually, like, your son.
That's right. Right on our living room floor.
Right.
Yeah, both our boys were. Yeah.
Right. And you describe how you were able to point in the specific spots, like where they were born.
Yeah. Yeah. It's totally true.
And that's really cool. I'm sure they reached an age where you were all, like any parent, you start thinking about their schooling, right? Mm-hmm. I remember when my wife and I started having these conversations probably 2 years ago, like my son was getting to be about three. It's like, hey, what are we gonna do about school? You all decided, instead of going through public schools and not even traditional homeschooling, you decided to keep them home and do what's called unschooling. I know you don't like that word. You talk about that in the book, but can you describe what unschooling is and how it's different from traditional homeschooling?
Yeah, I mean, the simplest way to put it maybe, which still doesn't really explain anything, but to help to understand that there is a difference there, which is that all unschooling is homeschooling, but not all homeschooling is unschooling. So a lot of homeschool, in fact, the majority of families that choose to homeschool generally follow a pretty set standardized curriculum, and that is not what we do. And so the other way I like to talk about it, and that's relatively concise, because I think, you know, one of the things about our style of education and the way our kids learn is that it is really hard to sort of talk about in really bite-sized pieces. It becomes it's a really sort of nuanced big picture thing.
Right.
But the other term I've come to really like that I think begins to sort of express what some of our philosophy is that. While the public education system and standardized curriculum-based education tries to make learning happen, our style is to try to make room for learning to happen. And so by that, what I mean is that, like, you know, we try to ensure, and we do, I think, ensure that our kids have a lot of flexibility and freedom in their day-in, day-out schedules so that they are able to follow those pursuits that are of most interest to them. It is true that I don't really love the term unschooling. It's kind of the one that's caught on in the national consciousness to the extent that any of them have. And I guess the problem I see with it is that it sort of describes what we don't do. It doesn't really describe what we do. It's like, why do my kids need to be unschooled? They've never been to school. If anyone needs to be unschooled, it's me, you know, it's my wife, right? We are the ones who sort of, you know, myself less than her, because I left the public education system at a pretty young age, but we're the ones who went to school and had that, you know, sort of in some ways suffered for that experience and really need to sort of try to undo it. I think in some regards.
So that must be hard though, because you too had this experience of what education's like. So is there that temptation or that tendency to be like, sit down with your sons and like make every moment a learning moment, right? Like, son, you know, you're making this bow here.
We don't do a lot of that. It happens for sure. I mean, look, you know, this summer we spent the summer building a barn and a house with them, and there's almost no way for that not to be a learning moment, whether you're actually, you know, sitting down and explaining, you know, the particulars of roof pitches and how you arrive at a particular roof angle or whatever the case is. It's much more sort of happening by osmosis than really sitting down. There is a certain amount of, and this has been particularly true, we found with math, which is one of those things that we at least have had a hard time incorporating without actually sitting down. So we do spend a little bit of time sitting down so that they at least have the benefit of learning some basic and even mid-level mathematics, because it's just really, I think, essential to their ability to thrive in the world that they have those skills. And I know, having talked to other parents who are on a similar educational trajectory, you know, so much of this has to do with the particular child and their temperament and their proclivities. And some kids, you know, they just love math, and you don't. That's not necessary. We have found that it is necessary for us. And that's actually another point that I'd like to make when I talk about this, is that, you know, the public education system and a standardized curriculum in general is basically one thing to a million different families. What this is a million different things to a million different families. You know, it can be whatever you want it to be. And that's another reason I think it's so hard to really define in any kind of concise way. It just means different things to different people.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people who are listening to this or hear, you know, they hear this concept of unschooling. They think, well, how do your kids learn to read, or like, how do they learn to write? But it sounds like they've done that.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think a lot of that sort of we have lost culturally, my belief, we have lost culturally a lot of confidence in our children's ability to learn without formalized instruction. So I in my experience, and of course there are going to be exceptions because there are children who struggle with very specific learning challenges. But the majority of children, you're not going to be, if you put them in a home where there are books, and you give them access to books and you read to them, you're not going to be able to stop them from learning how to read. You're exactly right. Neither one of our children was formally taught to read. Excuse me. They simply learned because we exposed them to books almost constantly. This actually brings me to another point and that I want to make sure to make before we're through with this conversation, which is that I think it would be very possible to do some version of this, of what we're doing, very, very poorly. Right, so a lot of this style of learning, and I think, is really, really dependent on a healthy, supportive environment where the parents are really engaged in facilitating their children's learning. So I think when a lot of people hear unschooling, they think, oh, it must be this like totally hands-off things. Your kids just do, you know, whatever they want all the time. They probably are just sitting around doing nothing, et cetera, et cetera. That may be true in some families who unschool or whatever you want to call it, but I can assure you that in our family, the level of facilitation that we do in order, to sort of help them find mentors and other people who can further their learning and their skills, it would be a heck of a lot easier to just send our kids to school, a lot easier. So we are, this is our choice, and we have actually structured our life around making sure that we are able to create these opportunities and facilitate these opportunities for our children.
So, you mentioned earlier about trade-offs, right, with the lifestyle. So, I imagine there's trade-offs with this. I mean, what is it, let's not talk about the negative trade-offs. Like, what is something that your kids are learning that they wouldn't be able to learn if they were in public schools?
Well, oh boy, yeah. So they have a whole range. I mean, I don't know. So I think it's hard to say, would it be impossible for them to learn some of these skills outside of the public school system? No, it wouldn't be impossible. But of course, the reality is that public school, if your child's in school, they're in school for somewhere around 40 hours a week, maybe more, maybe a little less, depending on their commute and whatnot. Then of course there's homework. And then of course there's the fact that, the average teen in this day and age is in front of a screen more than 50 hours a week. So you end up with a situation where there simply isn't any time to learn anything but what that curriculum lays out for you. So, if you're talking about sort of like hard, tangible things that my children have learned, I mean, they're both really, really proficient with hand tools. They're both extremely proficient in the wild. They spend a lot of time out in the woods. They do a lot of hunting and foraging. Either one of them could build a shelter. They are proficient with most domestic tasks. Either one, if there's a tear in their pants, either one of them can sew it up themselves. They're proficient in most of the skills that you actually need in order to make your way in the world outside of the sort of moneyed economic system. Now I realize that this starts to sound a little bit like we're just raising like a couple of survivalists and that's the only goal, and that's not the case at all. The other thing, so which brings me to my other point, which is that it's not so much that these are the skills that we think that our children have to have. These are skills that are an outgrowth of their interests and their environment, for sure. It's much more that we feel really strongly that they are learning a base level of resourcefulness and sort of self-reliance and ability to learn outside a structured system without that curriculum that we believe is going to serve them well no matter what it is they decide to learn. Right. So if they decide, it's possible, it's entirely possible that one of them or both of them are going to decide they want to go to college and they want to do something that, looks a lot more like what many people would consider a traditional first world career path. That may still happen. It's our belief that the resourcefulness that they're learning and the self-reliance that they're learning in the context of the skills they're learning are going to carry them through that path also. And confidence, you know, tremendous. I really, what I see and what I feel, and what I think is somewhat inherent to the you know, our cultural assumptions that children can't learn unless they're put into this specific environment, is a lack of confidence. And I think it's our own schooling as adults that has eroded that confidence, you know?
Yeah.
So if you're told that this is how you learn and this is how you have to learn, you start to believe that that's the only way you learn. So some people, you know, they use the term life learning to describe what we're doing. That's a pretty good term. I mean, you know, so it's like, you know, we forget, I think, that all of us are learning all the time. And we forget, I think, as parents, that our children, you know, are watching and learning from us all the time. And I think one of the reasons, maybe the primary reason we have forgotten these things is because we've come to understand and we've come to associate learning with a very particular style of standardized instruction.
I think this segues nicely to this another point you make in your book about how you talk about how we want children to be responsible, but we don't give them responsibility so that they can be responsible.
That's right.
Kind of segues nicely. So, I mean, you have done things with your children, with your sons at a young age, that a lot of, you know, suburban American parents would be aghast. Oh my gosh, why would you let your sons do that? I mean, talk about some of the things that your sons have done and their ability to be resourceful and adapt and to take on those responsibilities.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess maybe the most obvious is that, you know, they each had a belt knife, you know, before they were done with their fourth year, finished with their fourth year. I should say that there, you know, for us, it's not like we've never really said that there are these arbitrary ages at which they should be granted these responsibilities. For us, it's much more, you know, and this is, again, you know, this is one of the benefits of having them at home and being able to observe, which is that, you know, it's really clear to us when they're ready for particular responsibilities. Whereas it may not be so clear if to parents who don't have the luxury of spending as much time with their kids as we do. So they started on knives super early. And that was really an outgrowth of the fact that, you know, Penny and I always have a knife on our belt and it's something that we use frequently. And, you know, the other thing we taught them to do really early on was how to doctor their own cuts, right? So, like, you know, yes, they've cut themselves many, many times between the two of them, fortunately never seriously. But, you know, the majority of the time that it happens, we hardly know about it because they'll just sort of come into the house and quietly go about getting themselves a bandage. It actually doesn't happen that much anymore. But, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, it wasn't uncommon. You know, one thing that's really interesting is that if you sort of step back and do any reading about, you know, from a more anthropological basis and look at how other groups of people, other cultures raise their children, it's very, very common, in other cultures for children to have much greater exposure to what we here in the U.S. would consider, you know, sort of heart-wrenchingly dangerous. So, you know, it's like I do believe that we have, you know, we overreact to the tangible risk in our children's lives, and we generally tend to, I think, to not react nearly strongly enough to those risks that aren't so tangible. You know, the risks of our children being sedentary, the risks of our children spending all of these incredible quantity of hours in front of digital devices without really thinking about that impact on not just their bodies, but their intellect, their psyches, their spirits. I mean, that's a conversation that just doesn't happen at all. And yet we worry, you know, we fret endlessly about the fact that they might cut themselves with a knife, right?
Abducted, you know, maybe, right, from their front yard or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, these are all things that, you know, they tragically do happen in a very, very, very infrequently. And unfortunately, you know, we have a media cycle and we have an ad-based media that depends on ratings in order to make profits. And so these are the types of events that garner the most coverage. These are the type of events that we hear about. And so We fear things that by and large don't happen. And in the process, we really, I think, do a lot of damage to our kids. So I believe, and so as my wife, you know, fortunately we're on the same page, this would be really tough if we weren't, you know, that it's really, really critical to a child, a human being's development, that they have an opportunity to take appropriate risk. Because I think that lack of appropriate risk and during the earlier stages of a child's life leads to inappropriate risk taking later in life.
I think you mentioned this, like,
that opportunity to, as you said, you know, to be responsible, to know and to feel trusted. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I know I was going to say, I think you mentioned studies where they said that if you, like, when we make things safer, like we actually make things unsafe, right?
Right.
In a weird counterintuitive way.
Yeah, I think there have been studies where it's like, as soon as you plant that notion, you know, that you plant that seed that something is unsafe, that in fact is when it becomes unsafe, you know, because that awareness sort of rises to the front, and actually can actually cause people, you know, through just, I think, the fear of that to actually attract that outcome in some way. I'd have to go back and look at that. It's been a long time. I've read those studies. It's been a long time since I've looked at what they actually found. But that was the upshot, was that sort of expectation of something being unsafe was actually in many times was what made it unsafe.
Interesting. So I'm curious, have you and your wife maybe had some parental angst about, you know, are we doing the right thing? Do you ever have those conversations at night and you're laying together? Is this the right thing? Are we actually doing the right thing for our sons? Or are you guys pretty like, yeah, no, this is it. We're doing the right thing for our sons.
I think if we didn't have some doubts, we probably wouldn't be very good parents, to be totally honest. So yeah, I mean, that's sort of a short way of saying that, yes, we do have doubts from time to time. I don't think we don't have big picture doubts. Like we don't think to ourselves, you know, oh my God, did we make the right choice to not send them to school? We don't doubt that. But within the context of what we're doing and how we're doing it, you know, we do occasionally have doubts. I mean, those doubts are what led us to deciding that we did need to institute some sit down math with the kids, because we sort of realized that, you know, as much as we liked the idea that they would just pick this stuff up on their own, that it wasn't happening. And so we realized that, you know, we needed to ensure that a certain amount of that happened. I don't worry about, you know, it sort of goes back to what we were talking about, like, you know, almost first thing, which is, you know, the sort of the plan and their future. And I do not for an instant worry about their ability to make their way in this world. I'm very, very confident that they'll figure out what it is right for them, and they'll figure out a way to make it work. And a lot of my confidence in that comes from seeing the ways in which they're able to sort of work through, you know, their problems and challenges at this stage in their life. So that I'm not worried about. But yeah, you know, specifically sometimes we think, you know, and I think again, it's like, I think any parent who doesn't on some level stop once in a while and question, you know, what it is they're doing, I think actually you can really benefit from questioning the process, whether you're sending your kid to school or whether you're not, or whatever your circumstances are. You know, we question sometimes, like, have we given them short shrift because we've decided to live, you know, in a lily white state where they simply just don't have that much exposure to other cultures and ethnicities. I mean, that's a real sort of trade-off that our kids live in. And so there's stuff like that, you know, and again, it goes back to like, well, what, you know, this brings me to another point I really want to make, which is I hear a lot from people like, well, what about all the opportunities they're missing out on because they're not in school? And the only like sort of honest response to that is, well, you know, of course they're missing out on opportunities, just like every child in school is missing out on opportunities that my children have, just like any child in any situation is missing out on opportunities. We can't, you know, this is, the world is just like this incredibly rich and diverse place. It would be totally impossible for us to expose our children to every possible opportunity that's out there for them. And I think in some ways, you know, the irony is that in some ways by trying to do that, which I think a lot of parents do, we get caught up in this sort of like rat race of like trying to create as much opportunity for our kids as possible. And in the process, you know, we schedule them to the hilt, to the point at which whatever that is they're experiencing, whatever opportunity we're trying to expose them to, they're really almost unable to absorb any of it because they're so overscheduled and overworked. I mean, I hear a lot from parents whose kids are in a more conventional educational, on a more conventional educational path, you know, how exhausted their kids are all the time. And I think that's a really tragic outgrowth of what has become, I think, the contemporary expectation for our children's education, which is that it's going to turn them into productive economic units. I mean, that's the primary goal now of our public school system. And I think that's a really tragic outcome.
Well, Ben, this has been a great conversation. Where can people learn more about your books and as well as your work?
If they want to read more and learn more, they can check out my website, which is benhewitt.net.
Well, Ben Hewitt, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Brett. I appreciate it.
My guest today was Ben Hewitt. He's the author of several books, but today we talked about Homegrown. You can find that on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can find out more information about Ben's work at benhewitt.net. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy the podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you go give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher to help get the word out about the show and give us some feedback on how we can improve the show. As always, I appreciate the continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.